Okay. Last week, what did we do? We came to the realization that the idea of counting, like by counting the Omer, is something which we find occasionally in Judaism. One of the questions that was raised, if the counting that we have should always be understood the same. The command to count, which could be understood as simply a way of expressing the need of getting from point A to point B, or counting could be understood as not only, let's say if you visualize a ladder, it's not simply, if you look at the ladder of Yaakov, it's not simply that the ladder has its feet on the ground and has its head up in heaven. Each rung would represent a level of spiritual growth. And therefore, if you, it's not about getting an elevator and going straight up to heaven, or you know, being transformed in some Star Trek type of movement, but rather it's each step is significant. So when you look at the Omer, for example, so is each step going to be a significant step, or is it simply that the main thing is that we have to get to number 50 and everything else is not really relevant? On the other hand, we have a similar, perhaps a similar process regarding the counting of the years of going towards the Jubilee, going towards the Yovel. And there, even linguistically, you have very similar terms which are used, and is this something which is the same? The third time that it says a commandment of counting in the Torah is where a woman who is a Zava, who is commanded to count by the laws of Nida. And over there, again, is it simply a question of getting from point A to point B, or is there some kind of significance along the way? And maybe we're mistaken to even compare all three, and maybe they're not the same. Maybe each one has its own concept. Now, with the Omer, let's break it down a little bit more. There's really a couple of different things. One of the things that we noted from the very beginning last time is, what are we counting between? What are the two events which are being represented? One event is the Korban Omer, which is brought on the day after Pesach, Mechrat HaPesach, Mechrat HaShabbat. One is the Korban, which is being brought, and the other is the Shtei HaLechem, which the Bikurim, on Chag HaBikurim. To read into it, and by the way, let's again recognize what that is. That's an agricultural holiday. To read into it history in terms of this is when the Jews left Egypt and this is when they stood by Mount Sinai, perhaps is absolutely correct. And one of the things we saw last week is how many of the commentaries were fond of that kind of interpretation. But nonetheless, that's not what's said in the Torah. And it's my opinion, again, the Rambam does not need me to back him up, but it's my opinion is that the brilliance of the Torah is taking agricultural holidays and giving them a historical meaning, and when they get merged together, you then have what we can call theology. Because theology is going to be the merger between the day-to-day life, which in those days was agriculture, the day-to-day life, with history. Now, when the historical events take place at the same time when there are agricultural, let's say, benchmarks, that's something which is significant. Now, again, if you're cynical, as many of the modern scholars will be, they say, oh no, there were these ancient agricultural holidays, and the Jews are looking for some reason for them, and therefore they created this whole mythology. We're aware that other cultures had holidays at the same time. Of course they had holidays at the same time, because these were times of the year that were important, that were significant to the ancient farmer. What happens with Judaism is that the Jews are taken out of Egypt in the beginning of spring. That becomes something which is significant, which means that all the rites of spring that one can speak of, which really is a sense of rebirth, that becomes the rebirth of the Jewish people in the springtime, connects to the agricultural experience. It's not just the tulips that come up. It's the entire Jewish people reemerge. Now, all that had to do with the counting, but again, with keeping an eye on the agriculture. There's another thing as well. The counting itself is something that we noted. The Omer itself is something which we really didn't get into. Elaine threw out under her breath last week, maybe we should speak about the fact that the Omer is made out of barley. Barley is something which was not considered to be human consumption. It was something which was considered to be animal food. And then you have a very interesting process that takes place, that we move from all year, when we're permitted to eat bread, to this prohibition against bread, only eating unleavened bread, eating matzah, going from the matzah to going down to animal types of food, and then counting the days and getting to the point of eating from the shtei halechem, which is the only time during the year that we're going to have something which is really chametz, which is being brought inside the Beit HaMikdash. Now, again, once you realize that you're going from bread to matzah to animal food, working your way up back to regular food, you realize that there's a larger process taking place. What is this process we still need to understand? And there may be some broader elements that we're not even noticing yet, which may be a part of the story. Let me now raise a question to you, and then we're going to look into Midrashim. The question comes down to one of cause and effect, and we touched this last time as well. Why do we count today? Do we count because the Jews indeed counted when they left Egypt? Or do we count because when the Jews left Egypt, it happened to have been 50 days? Or it has nothing to do with either of this. We count because there's 50 days between when you bring one korban to the other korban. I know that question wasn't clear enough yet. What's the cause and what's the effect? Is the cause that they first counted then, or is the counting something which only takes place at a later time? I mean, it's quite clear that when you read the verses having to do with the Omer, it does speak about specifically when you enter into the land of Israel. This is something to do with agriculture. It does not make that much sense. They would have been following this particular law in the desert, including the counted, including the Korban Omer. What need do they have for it? What were they eating at that point? And the answer is, what were they eating? They were eating man. And then we noticed something which was at least interesting to me. In source 13, Vayir'u b'nei Yisrael, and the children of Israel saw, Vayomru ish el achiv manhu, and one said to his brother, manhu, what is this? Ki lo yadu mahu, for they didn't know what it was. So, you have last week's time. Sorry. Sit. Vayir'u b'nei Yisrael, vayomer ish el achiv manhu, ki lo yadu mahu, they didn't know what it was. Vayomer Moshe lehem, hu halechem asher natan Hashem lachem la'akla. This is the bread. By the way, it's interesting, it uses the word bread in this context. So here you have lechem, and then what is it in the next verse? Zeh devar asher tziva Hashem liktu mimenu ish lefi ochlo omer lagul gelet. How much would you take? Each one would take an omer. I saw brought down today, an omer is two and a half liters, I believe. Is it a lot? No, one sec. Yeah, 2.5 liters. It's the volume of 43 eggs, if any of you need this for your recipes. So that's the volume. Don't ask me why 43 eggs would fit into 2.5 liters. I don't know. This is what it claims. And who am I to argue with recipes? Yes. This is the first time it's used. This is the first time it's used. The next time that it's used is in the context of the Korban Omer, which would then bring us to the conclusion, which you're really saying, or you weren't sure if you should accept it yet, but you're saying if in fact these are the only two times that it's used till this juncture, then it would sound to be that there's some kind of an intrinsic relationship. And over here, that not only do you have the Omer, you have the Lechem, and over there you have the Omer, which leads to the Lechem. Of course, there is a difference. And in order to bring out the difference, what bracha would you eat when you eat the man? If you don't know this, God will not give you man. Yeah, do you say shahakol, or do you say hamotzi lechem min hashamayim? Because you can't say hamotzi lechem min haaretz. By the way, rabbis with too much time on their hands have discussed this point as well. And there are articles written on this and research done on this as far as what is the proper bracha to say on man. But again, you obviously can't say hamotzi lechem min haaretz. You could say, by the way, borei minei mizonot. Because what does borei minei mizonot means? That God created various forms of sustenance. Right? So this is a varied form of sustenance, but again, you couldn't say motzi lechem min haaretz, you could say hamotzi lechem min hashamayim, you could say borei minei mizonot, or if you want to cop out, then you could say shahakol, which is always the cop out. Yeah? What about it? You could make a claim. I mean, it almost gives us like this time capsule type of feeling that we're putting this stuff away. But it's you could see it in those terms. So now we realize that there may be some connection between the man itself. Now really, let's think about this. What is man? Man is heavenly food. So heavenly food is probably as different as you can get from animal food. Right, but barley is considered to be animal food. What would Zaidi say when you give him lettuce to eat? How would he say it in Yiddish? How would he say it? What do you think, I'm a horse or something? A fair...
You're talking about...
Not your husband, your father. My Zaidi, what would he say?
Especially like hay and barley.
What would he say? Yeah. Give it to the horse. They're saying, what are you feeding me? He'd eat it, right? But he'd complain. But how do you say it in Yiddish? He would say something fared, right? He would say... No. I'm not imagining. He would say this. He would say this. If you give him salad or barley, things like that, he'd say, this is food for an animal. People don't... What? So you're going from food, which is animal food, and then you're moving up and you're comparing it with something which is absolutely divinely food. Now, there's one more thing which comes to my mind, at least, when I think about heavenly food. What do you think? And I know what I think already. What do you think when you think about heavenly food? You think about Gan Eden. Why? Because everything I teach... Exactly.
The fact that you're getting lechem without any effort whatsoever.
Exactly.
That relates to your spiritual, level.
Correct.
Right back to earth.
Correct. Which means in Gan Eden, man got food straight from God, heavenly food. Which, by the way, therefore, being in the desert is very much a Gan Eden like experience, where God is taking care of everything, where God is micromanaging, and you're under complete divine control, which, by the way, is probably something very frustrating and very difficult, which I'm sure you've heard about before and people have spoken about. On the other hand, the curse of leaving Gan Eden is the curse that now man will have to work the ground, and now bread will have to come from the sweat of one's brow. Incidentally, once we're going back to curses in Gan Eden, what other curse would you now be perhaps willing to somehow connect into this discussion?
The pain of childbirth,
which a person would count in the earth. And for that man, Nida as well is mentioned in that verse, which means blood of menstruation and so on, now may be intrinsically related back to the same concept of counting, and maybe things are more interesting. And now if you go to the third counting, what was the third counting? The third counting was the Yovel. What is the Yovel? If things really returning all the way back to where, the way they're supposed to in the beginning, so now maybe we see a connection in the various things that are involved in counting, although we have no idea why there is this connection. We have no idea why counting is necessary for these things, and that's something which we still need to understand. Yeah.
But it seems like in Gan Eden, what happened is there was no intermediary process. like you conceived and gave birth on the same day without pain. You got your food. It's like the man just comes down. You don't have to plow the field. And part of the curse, if you want to call it that, or the teaching, is that you have to go through this very painful process suddenly. You have to go out, and you have to plant, and you have seed, and you have to pray, and you have to harvest, and then you get your bread, and the same with childbirth. So is the counting maybe a way to transform the process?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Why are you saying this is a
curse? It's
very difficult to live on a level where tam ha'etz katam ha'pri, which is the way it's described. Where the tree tastes like the apples, not just the apples taste like the apples. Where everything is perfected and there's no need to perfect, which means if there's no need for man to perfect and there's no process that we go through, then it's not just that you're in.
Because you have nothing to do.
But what do you have to do? What do you have to do?
Right, to make sure that you're maintaining that relationship. Right?
Which is described. Somebody have a chumash here? Right after they hear God's. If I can read the signs. Yes, say it louder, they can't hear you. Translate.
And they heard the voice of Hashem Elohim going in the garden to.
They're hanging out with God. That's what it is. They're hanging out with God. Complete innocence, hanging out with God. Getting to sort of a level that we can't even begin to imagine. But again, what's the result of sin? And it's the most pathetic verse in the entire Torah. And we have many, many candidates for the most pathetic verse. This is the most pathetic verse in the entire Torah. What does it say? They try to hide from God. That's what it says. They try to hide from God. I know that. That's why it's pathetic. No, it's like
hiding from God.
Read the next verse. Which means, and they hid from God. They hid. They were playing machpoim with God. You know what machpoim is? Hide and seek. Right? They're playing hide and seek with God.
But then God plays too. He says, "Where are you?"
Where are you? Where are you is an existential question. God does not have to, right? God does not have to go and look and say, "Okay, give me three guesses and maybe I'll find you." It's not.
I think he was giving them a chance.
Of course, of course.
But there's also a way we learn back into Gan Eden as Ken, who went back to Gan Eden a year ago. There is a way of doing it right.
There is a way, but now let's at least realize a couple of things. Gan Eden is about being together with God. Being together with God is a very difficult thing to do. Because what's the human response to that? What would we prefer to do?
Watch TV.
We'd prefer to hide. That's one way of doing it. We would prefer to hide. And when we prefer to hide, we would prefer to sin. And we would prefer all of the complications of sin, because hanging out with God is something which is very, very real, and things which are very, very real are very, very frightening. So now let's go back again. In Gan Eden, what do we have? In Gan Eden, we have bread coming directly from God, or food, sustenance coming directly from God. We have no processes taking place, except for maybe one, which I'll try to get back to. There's no movement going on from one thing to the other, except for one. What's the one thing which has been counted till this point? There is one counting going on. The days of the week. Which means there was one day, and there was 2 days, and there was 3 days, and there was 4 days, there was 5 days, and 6 days. No, it's the one, meaning there's one more counting that should take place. What's that? And what should happen then? That means that what are Adam and Chava supposed to do at this point? They're supposed to count one more day. And then, by the way, not one more. They have to count one day. They have to get till nightfall. What happens when you get to nightfall? It's Shabbat. And what are they then supposed to do when they do get to Shabbat?
Eat from the tree.
What do you do when you get to Shabbat? You make Kiddush. They're supposed to make Kiddush. That's what they're supposed to do. That's as far as they have to do, which means that there is this idea of counting that needs to take place, and they're very, very close to it. I mean, there are various midrashim that speak about what point of the day, you know, was it, what happened in the first hour of the day, the second hour of the day, the third hour of the day, and so on. And they're very interesting midrashim because they also have implications in terms of eschatology, as far as, you know, what the process of the coming of Mashiach will be. But it seems that what Adam needs to do is to go one more step, and that for some reason they're unable to do it. The way that various, and this is especially true in the Kabbalistic and the Hasidic description of the sin in Gan Eden, this is something that we've discussed before. What takes place is that the sin is considered to be an Eitz Hadat Tov V'Ra. What kind of tree contains both a feeling of knowledge, but a confused feeling of knowledge? Eitz Hadat is grapes, and therefore it's wine. It's something which intoxicates. And according to the commentaries, what they're supposed to do is to squeeze the grapes and put it in the Kiddush cup. Again, how literally you want to take this is up to you, but they're supposed to squeeze and put in the Kiddush cups and then have it that first Friday night and make Kiddush that first Friday night. So the sin in Gan Eden was, what was the sin? The sin was either miscounting or not counting, but the sin was making Kiddush too early. You're not supposed to get drunk on Friday afternoon. Right? You're supposed to, and you're not supposed to get drunk at all as far as Shabbat goes, but just to use the wine to create Kiddush, to create something which is holy, but something did go on, or let's put it this way, something was used before its time, something was used before it got ripe, and getting ripe could be understood in different ways. I mean, obviously, the wine at that point was not fine wine which had aged for many years, but that's part of the problem. But what they had done is that they had squeezed the grapes too soon, and the Sfat Emet says this clearly, that what they were supposed to do was first, and we've discussed this before, right? First what? First what? First eat from the Eitz HaChayim, right? Get your insurance policy down. First eat for the Eitz HaChayim, and then eat from the Eitz HaDat. Right? But that was the mistake. And Eitz HaChayim is understood as being Torah. That first they're supposed to somehow take in Torah, and that lines the stomachs, and again, talking metaphorically, and then you can take in the wine, then you can take in. Then you have the ability of discerning between Eitz HaDat Tov V'Ra, of understanding what is the good and what is the bad. But the problem over here was jumping straight to the Eitz HaDat. The problem over here was, but again, realize at least now the time frame and the time element, because there is some counting which is taking place over here, but is not being done properly. And as I said, in terms of both of the sin, both of the punishments that take place, women in terms of childbirth and so on and so forth, and men in terms of having to work and lechem, we realize now that there is some kind of convergence between what perhaps looked at us, at last week looked to us, as being completely independent concepts, one having nothing to do with another, only linked by this interesting fact that in both cases it talks about counting. But again, there may be something which is far deeper. Yeah.
Time to wait for
something to be there is not present. Right. And it's interesting because almost all description of Avodah Zarah, of idolatry throughout Tanakh, are always connected with immediate gratification. Right? When it talks about, again, the difference between Jerusalem is surrounded by mountains, right? Yerushalayim Harim Savivla, Jerusalem surrounded by mountains, versus the description that idolatry was worshipped under every leafy tree. Like any place we happen to be, you need immediate fix. Find it right where you are, turn over a rock, and do Avodah Zarah right there. The Avodah Zarah is always connected to immediate gratification, while Judaism seems to recognize that Jerusalem is surrounded by mountains, which means that there's a long, slow climb that needs to take place in order to have any kinds of real religious growth. Now, how... Nonetheless, man was created and just placed into this thing called Gan Eden. That does not make things all that simple. But maybe it was supposed to be very simple, and we're the ones who made it far too complicated. Now, with that whole introduction, I wanted to look at two midrashim that at first glance have nothing and very little, respectively, to do with Omer. Can I say something? No, leave them now. You know why? Because I cut out all the sources that had to do with them. But I wrote about this in Parshat Shmini. I wrote about the whole connection of the Tikkun of Nadan Aviyu towards the drinking of Noach and Adam and so on.
The counting process itself, it goes over the time period. So basically, the time itself, like Shabbat, it's holy, this is a time. So the counting itself raises it up to the holiness of Shabbat.
It could. But it's interesting that the counting does something to time, and that's what we still need. Hopefully to understand. Let's look at source number 4. Omer Rav Avun, Rav Nechemiah, Rav Yaakov Bar Abba, B'shem Rav Yehuda, Rav Simon, Rav Yochanan, B'shem Ben Lakish, and so on. La'olam al tihi mitzvat ha'omer kala be'inecha. You should never let the commandment of the Omer be light in your eyes. Sha'ayidei mitzvat ha'omer, that by virtue of the merit of the performance of the sin of the mitzvah of Omer, zacha Avraham liresh et eretz Canaan. Avraham was worthy to inherit the land of Israel. That have given you this land to you and your descendants after you, in order that you keep this covenant. What is this covenant? This covenant is the Omer. Do you see the connection, right, between Avram and the Omer? It's okay. None of the commentaries do either. people go searching for what in the world is this midrash talking about. But first, let's state what we know. The midrash says that because of the mitzvah Omer, Avraham inherits the land. Okay, and then it brings a verse, and the verse does not sound to us like it has anything to do with the Omer. What does Avraham have to do with Omer? So that's one thing. Although it is interesting, Reish Lakish Amar La'olam al tihi mitzvat ha'omer kala be'inecha, she'ayidei mitzvat ha'omer sa'kadosh baruch hu shalom bein ish le'ishto. That because of the mitzvah of Omer, God makes peace between man and his wife. Why? Because of the merit of the barley flour. What is he referring to? Not a clue.
I think he's referring out of the Kaaba.
If that's true, if what you're saying is true, it's secondary. That's not what he's saying. What he's talking about is anyone? Is the Korban Sota. Sota, a woman who's accused of infidelity, or to be more specific, a man where there's jealousy between a man and his wife. If you want, you can say, well, jealousy goes back to Gan Eden. That when there's jealousy between a man and a wife, and a husband says to his wife, do not be secluded with this particular man, and she goes and is secluded with that particular man, there are witnesses that she is locked in a room together with this particular man. At that point, she's a sota. What happened behind closed doors, we have no idea what happened. But a case of a sota is not simply the case of a jealous husband. It's a jealous husband with the wife who is perhaps somewhat insensitive. And therefore, when he says, don't be alone with this man, she ignores him. At that point, this woman goes through the process of sota. And the process of sota includes a couple of different things. One of the things is taking the words of the Torah themselves, writing down the section, then burning it, and having her drink water together with the Torah itself, which is a very, very bizarre thing. And the second part is that she brings a korban afterwards. She brings a korban made out of barley. So what this medrash is noticing is that if I'm going to look at the korban omer is somehow connected to the woman who's accused of being a sota, because it's the barley that connects the two cases. Does that do anything for you? Okay. So maybe we need to work. See, you still need me. This is good. So we need then to go a little bit further.
The jealousy between God and man for not keeping the promises to God. So in bringing the korban omer is the same thing as a wife saying she's not guilty, and I really thought of you, and I'm coming close to you. It's
very
same relationship between a husband and a wife.
Very good, but you still need. It's very good, but you still need the details. listen to the details. it's interesting. After the Jews sinned by the Chayta Egel, what did Moshe do? What? Yeah. Right. Now that process of forcing to drink the Egel is very similar to the process of a woman who's accused of being a sota, with of course one major difference. What's the major difference?
It's not gold. You're drinking Torah into the gold,
Right. One is talking about drinking something which has Torah in it, and the other is talking about something drinking avodah zarah. But we all remember that the whole idea of the Jews leaving Egypt is very much like a damsel in distress, and God comes down and says, come, take my hands, follow me off, where are we going? Doesn't make a difference, I'm going to take you away from all this. And we go run off with God into the desert. Right? Again, what verse says that? No? Havat kulotayach. What does that mean, avat kulotayach? The love avat kulotayach, right? God says, "I will always remember the dedication, the love of newlyweds." Right? That's what it's about. The love of newlyweds between God and the Jewish people. Lech techach rabbi midbar be'eretz lo zeruah. When you followed me into the desert, a place where nothing grows. By the way, what happens if nothing grows? How is our young bride going to provide? Sort of like the problem with every kolo husband, right? How is he going to provide if he lives in eretz lo zeruah? So what's the answer, right? God will provide. God and the father-in-law. God will provide. And if God's going to provide, that means that the food is coming from heaven. But let's stop there for a moment. What happens on the way to the chuppah? What's the chuppah? The chuppah is Har Sinai. What happens by the chuppah? Moshe goes, one second, I'm going to go up and bring down the ring. Moshe's a shliach. I'm going to go bring down the ring. And in the meantime, you know, the best man is standing there, dressed in gold, everything shining over here, and the Jews run off with the best man. That's not a good thing. Right? This is not the way it's supposed to work. So then what happens? So therefore this whole analogy with the sota is not that far. Again, based even on verses and based on psukim. Now I want to ask you something. Does Moshe melt down the egel and force them to drink it because Moshe has already learned the laws of a sota and Moshe is going to treat them the way a sota is treated? Or does the law of the sota now echo with the way that Moshe went and treated the people after the egel? What's the cause and what's the effect?
Moshe learned all of Torah and Har Sinai.
And again, I'll say, what's the cause and what's the effect over here, especially keeping in mind the laws of sota are not yet written, they're not yet given, the laws of sota. They come a little bit later. But again, you can say that this is what Moshe already learned. You know, when we talk about Moshe receiving the entire Torah at Sinai, we need to be a little bit more careful. Is it written Torah, is it oral Torah? Is it revealed Torah, or is it secret Torah? Are the mitzvot something which are in of themselves contain the holiness, or are the mitzvot expressions of innate holiness? Which means to say that Moshe already received it, I can certainly accept. I have no problem with this. But nonetheless, I think that the question is an interesting one because it could be that the issue is the opposite. But let's think this through for one more second. Why does a woman bring a korban of barley when she's accused of being a sota? If a woman's accused of being a sota, what exactly? Yeah, that is the image. Is animal behavior. What is animal behavior? One second. Let's not degrade animals. It's immediate gratification. And what else? It's instinctual. It wants to satisfy instinct. It wants to satisfy bodily needs on an instinctual level, and there's no kind of waiting, and there's no kind of payoff, and so on. And by the way, having said this again, if I want to go back to this idea that, you know, that you have to wait, you have to plant the food, and then you have to wait for the whole process and so on, which is really celebrated. When is that celebrated? Bikurim is that's what Chag Shavuot is about. When do we see this for the first time? That you can't eat chadash, you can't eat from the new thing till when? You can't eat till the shteilecha. You can't eat even the barley. Sorry, until and any of the grains until the Korban Omer is brought. Which means over here it signifies, even the counting over here signifies that you're allowed to now eat from the new produce. What happens by Bikurim is now you take from your new produce, you take from the fruits, and you bring the first fruits to Israel, which very much is telling us that when we do have something which is new, do it in the proper time, do it in the proper context, wait, use it for holiness, don't just use it for immediate gratification. Over here, the other thing, you know, in terms of Nida as well, which is talking about that there are times where there's separation, there are times that there's not going to be immediate gratification, there are times that you need to wait in order for a process to take place. That, as I said, is this other time that we find this counting, and it's becoming very intriguing to me because it sounds like there's some kind of a connection. Yeah?
I find it kind of distressing that, you know, the woman is found not guilty, and she's saying she still has to bring a korban.
Mm-hmm. No, but she is guilty. She's
pardon?
She is guilty.
If she is guilty?
No, she is. Let me explain. She's not guilty of sleeping with this guy, but she's guilty of bad judgment, of being secluded with this guy.
But it pertains if she was secluded. What if she wasn't secluded? What if it was a
then she doesn't go through this whole process.
Well, how do you determine whether
if they're witnesses? It needs three witnesses.
So there has to be two witnesses.
Right.
Because that answers the sense. I was going to say, I was thinking that it might relate to renewing the woman if she is clear. Because no matter what, she's going to be tainted. It doesn't matter if the husband takes her back or not. Who wants her after that?
No, if the husband tries to doctor and get you know false witnesses and so on, so all this is it becomes his guilt, and there's a whole another section that needs to be understood. But over here, what we're talking about is poor judgment, and she's guilty for poor judgment of bringing the offering, and that's for being secluded. You know, whether she's guilty, what happened, that's a whole separate question. So again, what I want to then start to ask, is it possible that the whole process of Sota, which has which elements to it? It has the drinking from these bitter waters, Mimirarim, it has drinking from these bitter waters. It has another element to it of bringing the offering of barley. And now we go back. The Jews were guilty of this Egel Hazav, this golden calf. And afterwards, Moshe then breaks down the golden calf, forces them to drink it. Now, this other element of this barley offering, could this somehow, when we get to the Omer now, be connected to this other section? Again, one way or the other, whichever one is the impetus, whichever one follows is of no interest to me for this moment, but is there some kind of relationship? So let's bring up another point then. What caused the problem? No, we'll leave it. We'll leave it for a moment. And we'll leave it for a moment, and I'll just bring in one more midrash, and then we'll come back to it. Yeah.
The only thing that's bothering me is the train of thought.
You mean you're following the train of thought?
There's a train.
I missed the train.
Is it possible, maybe I'm missing, it prejudges the Jewish people because we haven't done Heta Ego?
Okay. Hold on to that. Good. Hold on to that. Wait. I'll get to that. There's another medrash, which is almost as difficult. It's a little easier than the first. It's almost as difficult, but let's look at it. Source number 5. You will recognize this, fans of Megillat Esther. Will recognize this. Maher kachet ha-levush v'tasus v'yikach ha-manet ha-levush v'tasus halach lo etzel Mordechai. If you're a Haman fan, then this is like a really bad part of Megillat Esther. If you like the Jews, then this is when things really begin to get good. Kaven shehigidu leMordechai shehuba. When Mordechai heard that Haman was coming to him, nityare, he got very frightened, admaod, exceedingly frightened. But Yoshev v'tamidav lefanav, amar lahim l'tamidav, benai, rutsu v'vdilumikan, v'hibdilumikan. He says to them, run and get away from here. Because again, what does he hear? He hears that Haman is coming for him. If Haman is coming for him, this is, right? Keep the czar far away from us, right? So if Haman is coming, this is a very bad thing. Go away, run for your lives. That you should not get burnt from my coals. That means that if I'm the one that he's mad at, why should you suffer from this? Go save yourselves. Shari Haman Arashaba Lahargeni. Haman is certainly coming to kill me. Umru, they said, Im tamut namut imcha. If you're going to die, we'll die with you, we're going to stay. Amar Lahem, he says to them, Im kem na'amod v'tfila. Let us at least stand and pray. V'niftar mitocha tfila. Let us be taken as we're praying at least. The chaslon slulaton, they finished their prayers. Yitbon va'oskin behulchot mitzvata omer. And they sat down and they started learning the laws of the omer. Now why are they learning the laws of the omer? This is easy. At least, no? Why are they learning the laws of the omer? Because not only is it Pesach, it's the exact day that the Korban Omer is brought. Which means this is Inyana Dioma. This is the topic of the day. This is what's done. Because remember, she fasts on Yud Gimel, Yud Dalet, Tedvav, and now it's time, Tedzayin, now it's time to, right, that's the 3 days in preparation for the party, has the first party, can't sleep, going, that means that this is the day that the Omer is brought. So they finish davening, what should we learn, what should we do? So let's learn Omer. Now, first of all, there's a great idea of irony in this. I'll tell you what the rest of the Midrash says. You can read it later if you want to. Haman comes and he has to wait patiently for them to finish learning. Why? Because Haman can't go and kill him now. Why? Because now the king has told him to go put all my nice clothes on him. Which means it's no longer Haman acting on his own. Now Haman becomes the shliach, a messenger, an emissary for Ahasuerus. So Haman waits patiently and says, okay, what was this stuff that you were just saying? So they explained it's about the Omer. And he goes, one second, you could take barley, 2.5 liters of barley, and you can give it to God as an offering, and God's going to accept this. Now, think of the way that Haman is thinking. You're Haman. How much money have you put down so far in order to buy out the Jews? You've put down a fortune. Right, again, the whole background of the story is this amount of gold and silver, kesef, really, that has been put down, so that he could do to them as they wish. And he then, and barley, again, what is barley? It's animal food. So you could take 2.5 liters of animal food, and that's worth all the money that I put forth. Because what does Haman realize at this point? That he lost. He realizes that he lost. So, as far as the Midrash is concerned, this becomes this wonderful interplay between Haman's money versus the Jews', prayer. Now, there is more irony involved in it, and that's part of the irony of the entire story of Megillat Esther, namely the fact that the Jews are here. They're not supposed to be here. Where are they supposed to be? They're supposed to be in Eretz Yisrael. But you can now say to me, what are you talking? They're supposed to be in Eretz Yisrael. They're not supposed to be in Eretz Yisrael. Why not? Because they're in Galut. They're not supposed to be there. So let me point something out. Now again, it could be that all that the Midrash wanted to tell us is that the background of this is the Omer versus the money. And therefore, when you're looking in God's world or the way that God looks at things, it's not the amount of money, but it's really the dedication towards God. And a korban of 2.5 liters of animal feed, right? That's what it is, 2.5 liters of animal feed could be more valuable than all the silver in the world. Okay, then that becomes a very, very important statement. But there's a little bit more of a background which struck me as maybe a larger theme which can tie this together. It's both in sources 18 and 19. Let's look at 18 first. 18 is one line. 19 you'll have for homework. 18 is Gemara in Masechet Megillah, Daf Yud Tet. Ma ra'a Achashverosh shenishtamesh b'kelim shel Beit HaMikdash. What brought Achashverosh to do something so silly to use the kelim of the Beit HaMikdash? Akacha mishum dechashiv shivim shanin v'lo ifruk. You know what ifruk means? From the word purkan. What does purkan mean? Oh, what? To be saved. To be saved. Alanisim v'ala purkan. Yikum purkan. May save, right? Salvation come. Because he did the math and he knew the Jews was to go into exile for 70 years, and as far as he can tell, the 70 years were up and they weren't saved. So if the 70 years were up and he weren't saved, so obviously this whole promise of the Jews being saved is not true. What? It's not going to happen, and I can do whatever I want to do. At this point, God either doesn't exist, or God is sleeping, or God doesn't care. The Jews have been abandoned, and now I can do what I want. That's what the Gemara says, that he does the math of 70 years. This, in Source 19, it goes through the math, why he thought this. I do want to point out one interesting thing in terms of Rashi, in Source 20, which comments in Source 19. Bikesh lechriv, he wanted to destroy, Yisod sheyasad Zerubbabel b'Beit HaMikdash. Before I go further, you all know who Zerubbabel was. He's the one who started to build the second Beit HaMikdash. Finish the Rashi. Bimei Korash, Lifnei Achashverosh, Kamo Sha'amar B'Sefer Ezra. When did the Jews start to build the second Beit HaMikdash? Before the story of Achashverosh. Now I have to ask you again, why are the Jews in Paras and Madai? Don't tell me because they were sent into Galut.
Because they didn't want to go back.
Listen. It's the day after Yom Ha'atzmaut. We can say this. We understand this. They had a good life there. This was their choice. They decided to stay behind. The story of the anti-Semitism and the destruction of the Jewish people during the story of Purim is not what you normally think. Because you normally think, oh, the Jews were off there during the exile. Look at terrible things that happened during exile. 11 years before this, they started to build, the Jews had permission to come back and permission to start building the second Beit HaMikdash. What was the main problem? The Jews didn't want to come back. Which is, when you start to read the story of Megillat Esther, of, you know, using the Kelim and Kelim and Kelim Shonim and the Jews there in Shushan Abira, and, you know, what's their big problem? Their big problem is, how assimilated are they supposed to be? Right? How modern and how orthodox? That's the question. How assimilated should they be? Which means, when the king makes a party, should he go? Of course he should go. Well, what if the king is celebrating the fact that the Jews are not going back? What if he's celebrating the fact that this Beit HaMikdash is not going to be completed? Because he does his math and 70 years is up, and that's it. It's over. The Jews are staying here. It's over. The Jews are not going back, which means one thing that does scare Achashverosh is this potentially divine power. And now he realizes it's not the case. But as I said, you read that Rashi, and then you realize what's going on today, where, again, any Jew who wants to come back can come back. And I think you can even get a free ticket here. I'm not even talking nefesh for nefesh, right? You can get a free ticket, and you can come back, and but people don't want to. So why don't they want to? Why don't they want to? Well, no, today why don't they want to? Yeah, so you know what? You know what every American Jew should do? They should at least send their kids to the army.
That's a good idea.
Right? Keep your money. Don't give any money. Send your kids. Come, send the kids to the army. Okay, send the money. Hold on. What? So let's. Let's begin to understand something now. Let's think a little bit. Over here we have a story that takes place, and the background of the story is Achashverosh miscounted. What's the background of the story of the Chet HaEgel? Right? Let's look at Rashi, source 29. What's this, source 29? The people see ki boshash Moshe, that Moshe had tarried. Ki targumo lashon ichur, Moshe came late. V'chein b'sheish rachavo v'yachilu od bosh, ki kishalam Moshe lahar, amar lehem l'sof arba'im yom aniba, b'toch sheish sha'ot, b'sheish. Moshe said, I'm going to come in the sixth hour. Kishesovrim heim sha'oto yom sha'ala min haminyan. They thought you count the day that you go up, hu b'hu amar lehem shlemim arba'im yom. 40 days, not the 40th day, 40 days from now, and the background over here is miscounting. Now, let's think again. According to Rashi, again, this is based on Chazal, the whole sin of the golden calf is based upon a miscounting that took place. Does it now make sense to us that subsequent to this, when we every year celebrate Pesach, and we move on towards Chag HaShavuot, we're given a mitzvah of counting. But the counting itself is something which we're told to do. We need to count. Is it significant that the barley which is brought, when the barley is the offering which is given by the Sota? When I go back, right, which means that the process of the Sota, which is goes it now represents the sin of the golden calf, that's part of the tikkun of the Sota, that she needs to bring this offering for even putting herself in a compromising situation. That's the sin that it's brought for. Now the Jews are being told to take an offering of the Omer and to bring this barley, and therefore in order to elevate this type of animal feed. When we realize that, at least on that one level, and then we move over to the story of Purim, when the Jews are in exile. But let's think now a second. And the exile there as well is based upon a miscounting, a miscalculation, certainly a miscalculation from Achashverosh, but maybe a miscounting from the Jews as well. They feel it's not time for them to come back yet. It's not ready. It's not ready to come back. And maybe there's a miscounting there the other way, that the Jews are... Maybe we're not supposed to be counting and trying to figure out when the Geulah is going to happen, but when an opportunity presents itself, you take that opportunity. You're able to go back to the land, you go back to the land. There's nothing more to talk about. Let's go all the way back to the beginning and try to put together some of these loose strings as much as we can. Yeah? Say that again. Okay, give me one more second, we'll get back to Avraham. We'll finish up with Avraham. But before we go to Avraham, already in the Garden of Eden, there is a miscounting which is taking place. They're supposed to go from 6 to 7, from the 6 days of the week to Shabbat. That doesn't take place. Because it doesn't take place, now bread is going to have to come from man's sweat. Now we have implications in terms of Nida as well, which are based in terms of the representative curses. And now counting, which we find in both of those areas, becomes, as far as I'm concerned, far more intriguing. When we see over here that the process of galut, again, that's what it is. Where do we see galut? Galut takes place when man is thrown out of the Garden of Eden. That is the first galut that takes place. That means the very first galut includes within it this type of tikkun, this thing used to fix the cause for that galut. The Jewish people go down into Egypt, and when they come out of Egypt, they should be marching straight to Har Sinai and then straight to Eretz Yisrael. We have Galut, and now we have Geulah, and something wrong takes place on the way to Eretz Yisrael. What takes place, which is wrong? There is again a miscounting takes place. The miscounting that takes place ruins this entire thing. It eventually causes for them to be in the desert for 40 years, and don't make any mistake about this all as well. The backdrop to all of this is this element of wine, which I chose not to get into this week. More than necessary. But the element of wine is again there, even by the Meraglim, you may... What does it say? They bring back the wine. There are elements of the wine as well. We'll leave that. We'll talk about that. Belina there another time. But what we do then see is that the process of the Omer, the counting of the Omer, and the bringing of the Omer, may very well be related to what didn't take place on Har Sinai, or what got messed up on Har Sinai, namely the Chet HaEgel and the whole implication of Chet HaEgel. So now let me ask you, When is the first time in the Torah that we find somebody told to count? Somebody told, count. Correct. No, find it.
No,
we said that one more second. Source 17. Here's the first time that counting is mentioned in the Torah. God says, look up at the stars, look up at the heavens, and count. Can you count them? Which means, when Avram is told to count, why is he told to count? Why is he told to count? Because he can't count. He's being told to count, but he says, you really can't count, and that's really what the Jewish people are about. It's not about counting, it's about being beyond counting. I don't know if that made any sense to you yet. What happens right afterwards? He believes, which goes back to what Elaine said. But then God continues to say, take this offering, give this offering, and then what goes afterwards? And this is where the whole Galut is now mentioned for the first time within this section. You're going to go down for 400 years, and what are we told right afterwards? The fourth generation will return. Now this is something that we've also discussed in the past. Which is it? Is it 400 years or the fourth generation? So the way that Chazal understand it, there's a minimum, there's a maximum. And this goes back to the problem of counting. And this goes back to the problem of trying to figure out when the ketz is going to be. And figure out when is the time that we're supposed to take, you know, action. Which means if we were told that Mashiach is supposed to come in the year 5999, so people are not going to do anything till the year 5999. Over here we're told that even in terms of the very first Galut, or if you want to call it the first Galut, unless Adam's the first Galut, when we're told that the first Galut of the Jewish people to go down into Egypt, what are we told in terms of the end of this? We're given two numbers. We're given a maximum, four generations, 400 years. And what became the reality? Which was it? Which was it? It was someplace in the middle. It was someplace in the middle. Now, there could have been people there. Couldn't you imagine certain people, and I won't mention them by name, saying, excuse me, we're not leaving because 400 years isn't up yet. We're not allowed to come back. We refuse to participate in Moshe's leadership because obviously it's against the will of God. 400 years isn't up yet. God said we must stay behind. We were staying. I didn't say, I know. We refuse to go. We're staying behind. But rather, what do we see? Rather, what do we see? That when the opportunity comes to go, and God says the messenger, we pick up and we go. And that becomes the proper time. Which means time is not the significant issue. Because we realize that God transcends time. And we have the ability of having a relationship with God, and therefore transcending time as well. And just because sometimes processes are supposed to take a certain amount of time, it doesn't mean it always has to happen that way. And now you can say, but I'm contradicting myself in everything that I've said till now. Yeah. Correct? Mm-hmm. Because now it becomes very, very confusing. Yeah. How exactly does this work? And I think that what the issue is that there are steps. You need to take steps. You need to accomplish each step along the way. If a person tries to jump from the first step to the tenth step, what's going to happen? They're going to fall down all the way to the ground. And this is true in all kinds of areas, but especially in terms of religious development. You can't skip steps. And if you skip steps, you're going to later have to come back anyway to that other step and go back up again. It can't work any other way. But how long it may take for an individual to go from one step to the other, that's very, very independent. There are different ways of doing this. If God determines it's time for the Jews to go, it's time for the Jews to go. Which means there are certain processes that you need to go. One day, two day, three day, four day, 5 day, 6 days, seventh day is Shabbat. And you can't... But what happens if you're ready to take Shabbat in a little bit earlier? Are you allowed to take Shabbat in a little bit earlier? Are you allowed to start Shabbat a little earlier? But no, but a little bit earlier. A little bit earlier. The sin of Adam and Chava took place during Plaga Mincha when they could have taken Shabbat in. But their minds were not on Kedusha. Their minds were not on taking in the Shabbat. Their minds are, oh, this looks like good drink. Let's try these grapes. Let's squeeze these grapes and see what comes of it. Which means, could they have accelerated the process and brought Shabbat in early? Absolutely. In the same way, in our generation, the Jews who have determined to come back to the land now, we know that right now it's Erev Shabbat. We know that sooner rather than later, Mashiach is going to come. And all the Jews decide to come back and still live in the land here. What we've decided is that we're going to take in Shabbat a little bit early. Shabbat Shalom.
Omer, why isn't it called the bargain measure? When the word barley is not possible?
Because that's what they brought. They brought barley.
I know they brought barley, but it doesn't say, when they say come to order,